with a decline in living standards, with the continued attacks on unions. That's another question. Does the Verizon strike, is the victory of the Verizon workers or qualified victory, is it going to turn things around for the labor movement? Is it going to result in sort of an upsurge of labor, of new union organizing, etc.? I think yes and no. That's a great answer. Huh? I think in some places it will. In the Northeast, I think it's going to strengthen some of the unions in the Midwest. But obviously the big areas that there's a whole history here, don't we have time to go into, in the South and so on, that have to still be organized in a huge way, which will take more than little union organized drives, will have to be a mass social movement. That's not going to make a big impression. And I'm afraid that the companies are going to just continue with this sort of neoliberal austerity, attacking the unions like they have been. But we'll see about that, and that's something we'll report on the show. And before we get into more of the concrete gains that were made during the Verizon strike, I just want to say this is WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford, also known as Tufts Freeform Commercial Free Community-Based Radio, also known as Tufts Educational Radio. Many names for the programming here and what we do. And this is 91.5 FM. On your radio dial, go to WMFO.org to listen by computer. And we're going to continue now with Socialist Alternative Radio for another hour, and we have more on the Verizon strike. And if you went to the picket line to show your support for the workers, that's great, that's brilliant. Try to maintain those contacts somehow. Get in touch with the workers. Say, what do you think? How is it since you got back? I mean, the management, one of the reasons for the strike was management was just completely off the wall, nasty, crazy, mean to the workers, as they did an internal campaign to try to avoid going on strike. A lot of people might not know that. The corporate media didn't report on it, as far as I know. But in the big workplaces, Verizon, the unions, the CWA, the Communication Workers of America, and the IBW, they did a huge, program of protests and education, and they all wore red shirts to work. And at break time and lunch times, they'd have speeches and stuff, all trying to show the company that they were united around opposing the horrible things the company was trying to do. I mean, I'm focusing on the gains. I mean, what the company was trying to do was outsource huge numbers of jobs, lay people off, cut jobs, cut pension payments. I mean, you could go through a whole list of the work. Have the right to just move people hundreds of miles away rather than have adequate staffing in a certain area. They wanted to just have sort of like, workers, even if they were still in the union, they'd be sort of like temps, sort of like with no established work rules, but just like, hey, there's a crisis over in Illinois, and we have a lot of workers here in Massachusetts still. Let's send them over there to Illinois, and that will be part of the new contract. This is the kind of stuff the company was trying to do, and it was just horrific and really backwards. And all that stuff was successfully kept off, kept from being part of a new contract. Getting back to some of the gains that were made, and this was about 6 weeks on the picket line. The general idea is that good jobs were preserved. Standard of living for the workers was preserved to a certain extent. If I find out more, by the way, I live right next to a Verizon worker who, hopefully will tell me warts and all what happened. And of course, there are Verizon workers in Socialist Alternative and so on. But what I've heard so far is yet qualified victory, like sort of a status quo thing, keep the status quo with some improvements, but the improvements should have been a lot more. But let's look into those improvements again. Again, a 10.9% raise over the next 4 years with compounded interest, including 3% upon ratification, 2.5% on each anniversary of the contract. So there's a little sort of bonuses and thing like, well, the next part, for example, the bonuses I already mentioned earlier, first contract ever for nearly 70 Verizon wireless retail store workers. Now I heard it was more like 200. So that might be including more than a certain... I'm not sure. Anyway, I heard it was 200. Here it says 70. All call centers that have been threatened with closure in the Mid-Atlantic region will remain open. 3 of the 5 threatened call centers in upstate New York will also remain open. 6 workers affected in other 2 centers will be offered jobs locally in the company, so they're trying to hold on to the call center jobs. The new contract, oh, by the way, and that's another thing. I don't know if you noticed. I think the corporate media might have mentioned this a little bit. I saw one thing on it. So Verizon, like a lot of other corporations, are like, oh yeah, we're just gonna find the cheapest labor we can around the globe, and with the internet, you know, we'll just move that stuff over there, like call centers, and that's kind of infamous now in the financial sector, credit card companies using really cheap labor in other countries to have them call, all sorts of outsourcing. Where I work at Harvard, they're outsourcing jobs, some of the work I do, to India. Some boss came around and said, well, don't you want the Indian workers to have jobs? And I'm like, I didn't say this to the boss, it's a waste of my breath, but I basically said to other workers, I said, look, you know, I'm in an organization that helps organize workers around the world. And in India, there are jobs, okay? We fight for jobs, we fight for more money, but we don't fight to steal jobs from other countries. That's not necessary, and it doesn't help. It's a zero-sum game, because capitalism will always be looking around the globe for the cheapest labor, which is what they do, and when they center on it and exploit it, the workers start to organize, then they'll move on to the next place. But what's happening in China with the slowdown is basically a lot of the capitalists and the new capitalists and the sort of state capitalists in China, they're actually a bit worried about, which we don't hear about here, but there is a huge, and has been for 2-3 years, huge upsurge in labor struggles in China, unofficial struggles, struggles of that are organized. But just a lot of social unrest in China, which coupled with some sort of macroeconomic forces like the fall in commodity prices and so on, does equal less interest in investing in China, in that that like a shark always looking for the next victim, the capitalists looking for the next cheap labor center. So, of course, this has been going on for a while now, but Vietnam is one of the new places. The Philippines has been consistently a place to exploit the heck out of labor. And so in the Verizon strike, of course, it was discovered that they're setting up new call centers, closing them down in the U.S. and setting some up in the Philippines. So some workers from the U.S. went over to the Philippines and confronted them and tried to protest. And what were they met with? Not the usual group of police like here, which is bad enough, you know, robocops and all that, but instead actual military. The Philippine military shows up, coupled with private security, and tries to intimidate and shut down any protests that happen. And that's supposedly, you know, from the State Department, the USA democracy, you know, the Philippines. So that is an unfortunate way of keeping wages low. Like if the boss says, don't you want people to have jobs in India? It's like, well, I'd like to be able to, you know, have decent pay and jobs that aren't stolen from other people in other countries under the force of the military, you know, which is the same. There's a huge repression in India as well, of course. Let's see. We're back to Verizon gains by the workers and the Verizon strike. Did I say this one already? Verizon will add 3,800 call center jobs, 850 in the middle area region, 450 in the northeast. Several major contract initiatives will be reversed. There will be sustaining work for union members in their communities and returning a significant amount of pole maintenance work to the unionized workforce in New York State. There will be a 25% increase in the number of unionized crews doing pole work in New York State. Existing job security language will be preserved as far as transfers and seniority protections and retirement incentives. All of the company's proposals on forced interstate transfers of technicians were withdrawn. That was the thing I mentioned earlier. All proposed reductions of pensions were withdrawn by the company, and there will be 3 1% increases in the defined benefit pensions over the life of the agreement. So notice this term, defined benefit pensions. If you don't know what that means, it's basically what pensions were set up to do originally, that they would be a benefit for working at a company. The company would put money into the pension the way you would get a paycheck. It would be a reason, a benefit for working at that company, for all the value and all the profit. All the value, by the way, all the profit is created by workers, by labor, in any company, in any capitalist situation. And that was the little bit of return that we would get for making the rich richer. And now, of course, as the labor movement weakens, and as we still don't have any workers' party in this country, politically, we have pensions basically becoming non-existent. I read a statistic, which I hope is hope I have this wrong because it's very low. I think it might be. I think it's too low. But I read only 7% of workers have defined benefit pensions right now. Where I work at Harvard, with the collaboration of my union leadership in the mid '90s, they got rid of the defined benefit pension as the sole benefit, a pension benefit, and instead new people getting hired in would be hired into the scheme of Harvard putting money into the stock market, and they be encouraged to put their own money in. You don't have to put your own money in, but they're heavily encouraged to, and that would supposedly the combination equal the defined benefit pension. Because I've been there a long time, I was able to say screw that and stay with the defined benefit pension, although they still go ahead and do the other one in trying to entice you more into that. But the new workers after 95 don't have that option. They're just going to go in and gamble on the stock market. And like in the last downturn, 2007-2008, pensions were severely hit, so-called pensions, meaning whatever you want to call what I just described at Harvard. It's not quite a 401k. It's similar. And 401ks were really hit. Let's see. One last thing. Proposed cuts in accident disability benefits were withdrawn. Imagine that the company was proposing, and it's a hugely profitable company, by the way, and I gave those stats last time, but any proposed cuts in accident and disability benefits were withdrawn. Why would this company, this hugely profitable company, need to cut accident and disability benefits? That's when you're hurt, you know? This is going after the most vulnerable. I don't know. If you're looking for morality and conscience under capitalism with CEOs, look again, because you're not going to find it. And if you do find it among an odd capitalist, they're not going to be capitalists for much longer. By the way, this is going to seem like a big jump, not much of a segue here, but I just want to say that I'm mentioning it. The segue in my head, anyways, is a victory or a qualified victory. Unions down, but not out, and internationalism. So in Portugal, which didn't get covered here at all, as far as I know, by the corporate media, Lisbon Dockworth, I'm quoting here from socialistworld.net from June 2nd, quote, Lisbon, and that's this, that's the website of the Committee for Workers International. Lisbon Dockers' victory against precarious work. This is very interesting. Militant strike action blocks bosses' attempts to undermine collective bargaining. So they had a strike which started in late April, 20th of April, and wound up end of May sometime. The agreement, now it's not that many workers involved. Well, I don't know. Let me rephrase that. The agreement reached included adding 23 casualized workers into the union, into the collective contract, negotiated a new pay table and automatic career progression, guaranteed that all casual dock workers, about 70 in this case, this is in Lisbon docks, will be included in the collective agreement, effectively ending casualization in the Lisbon port in exchange for not increasing their salary for this year. Oh, that's not great. Anyway, the dockers were also forced the employers to stop using a parallel company created to hire casual workers. The threat of collective layoff, a desperate move by the bosses against the workers, was also dropped. This was a stunning victory against a brutal attempt by the Lisbon port private companies to impose zero-hour contracts. You know what that means? That's a European term. But zero-hour means basically you work here, but some weeks you might not get any hours. I mean, the closest thing I heard here was, I don't know if you ever had friends or you yourself have gotten jobs during the holidays, right, in one of these retail stores. And they're like begging for workers to meet the holiday rush, but of course they hire you as a virtual temp, even if you're not technically that, and you're working along, and you're starting to like get used to the groove, you know, and the exploitation and all that, making you a little bit of extra money, and then all of a sudden, and you think that you're very valued, you know, because you got them through this hectic period, and then all of a sudden, like January 1st or whatever, they kind of don't know you anymore when you call up or walk in, you know. What are my hours for next week? I mean, they don't want to lay you off, right? Because if they say you're laid off, then you can go to unemployment and collect unemployment, maybe, possibly, probably. And then their tax goes up. This is supposed to the disincentive to lay people off, which is minor, but it's there, is taxation going up to companies in Massachusetts, and this is probably the way it works in other states too, if they lay people off. So they hire all these people in these financial, retail places around the holidays in the U.S., give them what is referred to here as zero-hour contracts at a certain point to basically say goodbye without laying them off. Also, the company was trying to cut pay, force casualization, attack the general rights of the workers. Now, during this strike, dock workers, and this is a strike in Lisbon, Portugal, big port. I've actually seen it, actually been there. Dock workers were recently attacked by the capitalist class and the media, relentlessly attacked. In fact, they held steadfast as a testament to their courage, but more importantly, shows the importance and power of the organized working class, internationalism, and class solidarity. The Lisbon dockers are internationally organized in the International Dock Workers Council and were supported from important layers of other workers and trade unions, both home and abroad. The result also shows the level of class consciousness among the dockers, etc. It's a democratically run union, has called for the nationalization of the port sector, which it probably already was in the past, recent past. I don't know if listeners are aware, but Portugal has a strong left. I've been there. I've seen it. In 1974, there's actually a revolution in Portugal. They call it the Carnation Revolution. It actually could have been full-blown socialism after that, but the leadership of the revolution, mainly the Communist Party leadership, they weren't really interested in a real revolution. They were sort of dragged along and just wanted to get the best deal they could get for Russia at the time in terms of like foreign policy and stuff. And didn't feel at all comfortable or interested in really trying to fight for socialism. But they got enormous gains were made and still being felt in Portuguese society, the results of that. But of course, the right wing has tried to, take that back, destroy any of those gains that were made. And I would bet you that the docks were nationalized in 74 if they hadn't been already. But anyway, this is in a time of privatization and so on. This is a fairly rare victory, but a solid one, and one that we, the Committee for Workers International is publicizing in Europe. Now, getting over to the presidential elections, because we're starting to run out of time a little bit. So every show you've been listening to lately on Social Alternative Radio, we got to do the presidential elections. We got to do that whole thing. And it's not like I'm trying to express a weariness with the whole process. Not at all. I find it fascinating. It is fascinating. And it's very, very, very important to working people, obviously. But it's a bit relentless, too, right? The propaganda is huge to invest people into the two-party duopoly. And the whole question of Sanders, who's really doing a disservice to the left by running as a Democrat, but still tapping into a huge mood for change, for stopping, the huge crisis of student debt, the huge rotten healthcare system we have, the need for free education, the need for higher minimum wage. Sanders has tapped into that, and that's a good thing to publicize those issues, no doubt about it. But within the context of trying to reform the Democratic Party, it's a real dead end. But you got to, with Sanders, it's like, I've met him, I've spoke with him and stuff, and he did deal with the devil back in the 90s with the Democratic Party, even though he kept the independent label. And for some people, he even still has that socialist label, which really doesn't fit in reality in terms of what he believes in. But you basically have Sanders, you got to feel sorry for the guy, the way he's getting, he wants to play by the rules, and they keep changing the rules on him, And again, I'm not saying that to solicit votes for him. I'm going to vote for Jill Stein. I think people should vote for Jill Stein if she becomes the candidate for the Green Party. She's actually more of a socialist than Sanders is, although not quite a socialist herself. But we'll have a better program than what Sanders is putting forward. And so what's happening, though, is this week we have the California primaries, obviously, New Jersey primaries, some very important primaries. And I personally think, this is my personal opinion, I think Sanders might win in California. Now, what does this mean for working people and youth is maybe counterintuitive. I think it's actually not a good thing. Because not that I want Hillary to win either. I just don't think it, any Democrat winning anything is not going to help us. Any Republican winning anything is not going to help us. And so Sanders could win, and then it's going to be very interesting to see how much more they trade off in terms of committee assignments and committee power. He's already probably got the finance committee or something sewn up. And they're going to do more with the platform, give more left, make it more, put a left-wing tinge on the Democratic Party platform, which is meaningless. They never follow their own platform. There's no mechanism to make them follow it. Democratic Party, as we said in previous shows, is not a member, it's not a social democratic party, even though some pundits or whatever, some so-called intellectuals in America make that analogy all the time. It's not a social democratic party. It has no membership base the way so even devolved social democratic parties have in other countries. It has no official union affiliations where unions have block votes and so on in social democratic parties in Europe. The Democratic Party is a loose collection of people that say they vote Democrat, that that registered Democrat maybe, and then the core of, if you want to get to the point where you can call it an organization, you have, yes, a legal structure run by very wealthy elites, some of whom have held office or hold office, and that's where, and they will ramp up that organization during presidential elections and certain other local elections, and then tear it down again to its core. And there's no mechanism for saying to a Democratic Party elected official, you will be deselected or something if you don't follow the Democratic Party platform, because they never follow it. They routinely, of course, make tons of promises they never mean to keep. As far as Obama goes, there's a laundry list of them. Let's look back at the Employee Free Choice Act, EFCA. Obama got lots of my union dues and lots of other union members' dues into the Democratic Party based on the labor leaders either believing or pretending to believe that Obama and the Democrats would be better than the Republicans or not as bad. And they hung that around EFCA. So the ones that bothered to even talk to the membership in their unions, the labor leaders back in 2008, talked about the Employee Free Choice Act. This would be a new law that supposedly the Democratic Party approved of. It's in their platform. Obama loved it, was gonna make it sure it became law. And it was going to make it easier for unions to organize. Like you could have, for example, if a majority of workers in a workplace sign pro-union cards, they could have like an immediate election or be recognized instead of going through a long process they have to now, where the companies invariably hire anti-union, union-busting companies to come in and brainwash the workers to vote against what they already said they wanted, to drag on contract negotiations forever. There was a limit of a year, or else they had to go to mediation. There was all sorts of things in EFCA that would support quicker, better, more easy union organization. Not perfect, but it would be a step forward, definitely. And EFCA would have been a good thing, right? So what happens with EFCA, like so many other things in the Democratic Party platform, which, by the way, if you look at the Democratic Party platform as a piece of paper, which it is, it has full employment stuff in it. It has socialized medicine, not single-payer health care, socialized medicine provisions. It's got all this stuff that looks like a social democratic party, by the way, going back to that analogy, but is not at all a reality and never has been and never will be, because the Democrats are a corporate political party. And I know the liberals are like rolling their eyes, but Trump is worse than Hillary, blah, blah. Well, we'll get into that in a second. Trump is horrible, don't get me wrong. And the protests against Trump are great, although I don't support the beating up Trump supporters part of it. I think that's stupid and counterproductive. And Trump isn't a fascist. People have a right to go support Trump, even if they're really ignorant and sad for doing so. So I'm not saying that, like you're seeing in the media, they're playing up the violence of a few against some of the Trump supporters. By the way, some of the Trump supporters caused violence against anti-Trump protesters. That doesn't become clear in a lot of the corporate media stuff. But protesting Trump, because he's such a vile racist, such a moron, is perfectly nice and good and brilliant. And I'm can't wait to get in one of those protests, although I haven't yet, but people I know have, and people in Socialist Alternative have, and that's a good thing. But, you know, the whole thing, like every presidential election, I've been through many, many, many. It all comes down to so-and-so, McCain, Reagan, they're all worse. It's always the most important election, blah, blah, you know. And we'll get into that lesser evil thing throughout the rest of the campaign. Throughout the rest of the year, we're going to hammer that point, and we're not going to convince hardly anybody. I understand that. We're going to convince a tiny minority, but guess what? That minority is going to then hopefully become a larger, it will be actually a larger and larger and larger minority till it's a majority, because we do have most people in the U.S. prior to Sanders kind of messing with this, most people in the U.S. that were registering to vote, they eschewed, what's that word? I don't even say it. I can't pronounce it properly. Eschewed. They did not choose either Republican or Democratic party affiliations or, you know, voter designations. They said independent. Now, that doesn't mean, don't get me wrong, every independent isn't like some sort of socialist in waiting. I understand that. But that shows a certain level of disgust with the duopoly. And there are a certain number of independents that are open to progressive and left-wing independent challenges and party challenges to the duopoly, to the two corporate parties, Democrats and Republicans. And so that's a positive thing overall. It gives us something to work with, so to speak. And so lesser evilism, you know, will be virulent. It already is. It will get worse, as is most likely with Clinton and Trump being the candidates of the two corporate parties. But on the other hand, that has a sort of dialectic to it, and that is that a lot of that minority, decidedly a minority that won't buy into lesser evilism, kind of grows a little bit. More people get disgusted with the, that's the choice again? That's the choice? Even millennials, even people that are brand new to this are like, what? That's the choice? I don't know. I don't buy into that. And they will therefore be open to Jill Stein and hopefully open to building something beyond the election. A lot of people are calling the Sanders phenomena a movement. I reject that. I think it's pretty much an electoral campaign. But people that are interested in Sanders, people that are coming out to the rallies and so on, which is really good. I mean, I'm glad they're getting out and so on, and I hope they're open. I've been to the rallies, mixed bag in terms of talking to people. Some people really aren't there because they're not there because they understand anything about socialism or care about socialism. They're there because of Sanders. They like him. They like some of the demands. You know, it's the whole cult of personality that is such a part of American politics. It's kind of disgusting to. It's kind of hypocritical for American journalists and think tankers and pseudo intellectuals to you know, talk about like cult of personality in other countries in a disparaging way with someone like Putin or whatever, which I agree with technically, but and then not recognize in the United States that every political campaign of any size, even smaller ones, are built around personal individualized myths, you know. So-and-so is a great person. I like so-and-so. Let's vote for so-and-so, you know, rather than seeing the institutions that so-and-so represents, whether it's the corporatized Democratic Party or whether it's straight out, like in Boston, real estate interests, you know, or in Massachusetts. I had a job right after college with in Kerry's office inputting donation checks. A friend of mine got me this job over the summer one time. The checks I inputted were all, and I was doing most of them, if not all, were from real estate companies. They were from big law firms, big insurance companies, and all the stuff that ran Boston back in the 80s. Not so much the new take your choice of adjective to make it sound not like horrible capitalism. The entrepreneur, startup, blah, blah, blah. You know, I have this article about Uber. I'm not going to have time to get to. Really blows away a lot of the myths about that kind of stuff. Anyway, so back then it was the rich funding the rich to rule over the vast majority of people, just like now, if not more so now even. But that was pretty standard back then as well. So so basically, yeah, you're going to have this huge onslaught of lesser evilism, but it's not going to really make any sense, bottom line. And it's also going to have some rebels, some people that refuse to go along. And that will be, of course, socialists, a lot of socialists and others. And along those lines, here's a quiz for our listeners. Guess which presidential candidate top CEOs prefer? Hint, it's not Trump. And I said this when Diego called in, and it was, he guessed Sanders. And no, top CEOs do not like Sanders. Obviously, they wouldn't like some of his program things, although he's a very dutiful imperialist when it comes to, for the most part, when it comes to voting for war and so on. But anyway, no, more than half of Fortune 500 executives polled said they'd choose Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump in a hypothetical general election. Now, think about that for a minute. Of course. You know, Trump, with all his vile racism and incredible ignorance and so on, he's like a Berlusconi from Italy. He's like a Sarkozy from France a few years ago. He's like Reagan in many respects, although not as hooked up as Reagan to big business. Reagan was a tool of General Electric for a long time, the big corporation General Electric. Trump is this real estate guy, inherited his wealth, blowing a lot of it on his presidential stuff. And he's basically not, with all that, as well connected to the capitalist class, as much of a dutiful servant to the capitalist class as is Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton before her. And the corporation, the big CEOs, these are big Fortune 500 CEOs, they know that. 58% of them would choose Clinton. 42% said they would like Trump. And Clinton has seen a surge of financial sector donations since Trump became the presumptive Republican nominee, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that's like common sense for a Marxist, basically for a socialist. You're going to look at, Trump pushes the buttons, in terms of social issues. He's a complete reactionary, So is Clinton, by the way, if you look at her record. Clinton talks the talk about women's rights and defending children, but does not walk the walk in terms of legislation at all. And you look at, Clinton has even made a statement earlier in the campaign about, equivocation. She equivocated on pro-choice, on abortion rights, which is one thing the Democrats use especially in the Northeast to get a certain loyal voter base time and time again. When in reality, if you want to go down that road, when did Roe versus Wade come in? Another little quiz. What was the political climate like during Roe versus Wade? Well, it came in during the Nixon administration. One of the biggest conservatives of all time. Another crook, another idiot, yes, but a huge conservative. With a lot of power in a Supreme Court that was dominated by conservatives, and yet we had abortion rights for the first time in this country during the Nixon administration. How does that happen, you say? How does that fit into the lesser evil paradigm? It doesn't. It blows it apart. There was a huge mass movement on the streets that started out against the Vietnam War and spread into many other movements, women's rights, environmental rights, gay rights. It was a huge mass movement, very, very effective, changed societal mores and attitudes in many, many ways that are still being felt. And that's what pressured big business and the government they run to make concessions on abortion rights deeper than ever before. And under Clinton, by the way, her husband, so we hear, less and less people had access, during the Clinton reign, during the 8 year of Clinton, less and less people had access to abortion rights than in all the time previous, going back to Roe versus Wade. So there was an acceleration of abortion rights disappearing at the county level, at the state level, and so on. Was Clinton directly responsible for that? In many cases, no. Did Clinton lift a finger to stop it or even publicize it? No. So it's not all what it seems, folks. You really need to look beyond the myths. And let's get into that a little bit more. This is an article I'm going to quote a little bit from. Can the Democratic Party be reformed? Published May 2016, socialistalternative.org. Actually, I'm sorry, published in Socialist Alternative number 24. It's a paper copy, and also I think it's on the website. It has a couple companion pieces if you really want to get into it. How corporate interests maintain control and what workers' parties achieved. I'm not going to have time to get into all this, but I just want to mention that a few things. This is, again, the theme is, can the Democratic Party be reformed? So Sanders has said, and Sanders' wife and Sanders' campaign manager, they've all said this is their main purpose for running and has been all along. That was one reason why Social Alternative initially didn't support Sanders, because he was running as a Democratic Party candidate. That eventually changed in various ways, but the general attitude towards the Democratic Party by Social Alternative and by others who see through the Democratic Party is constant. I know there's a bit of a contradiction there, and we can deal with that some other time, but right now I'll just say that we warned, Social Alternative warned, that while running in the Democratic Party primary may seem simple, a simpler way forward, the Democratic Party is a corporate party. Despite its progressive appearance, it has consistently betrayed every major social movement. by first attracting them, then sanitizing them to the needs of the corporate agenda, and that's why it's been nicknamed, the Democratic Party has been nicknamed, quote, the graveyard of social movements, unquote. Now, what are the historical roots of the Democratic Party? Well, it began as a party of the oppressing class, first as the party of the slave-owning class, then after the abolition of slavery as a political party funded and dominated by big business. Beginning in the 1930s, it came to be seen as the party most tied to the interests of organized labor, black people, and women, but all the way through the 60s, it still had a Dixiecrat wing that fiercely defended Jim Crow segregation in the South. At every point in its history, on every essential issue, whatever the class interests of the corporate elite was at stake, it has taken the side of that class against the interests of the 99%. In the crucial area of U.S. foreign policy, the Democrats have been loyal spokespersons of corporate interests overseas. The Democrats initiated the U.S. imperialist wars in Vietnam and Korea. They supported Bush's invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. Obama's continued U.S. involvement in these wars, despite officially ending them in some cases. I threw that in. Back to direct quoting. On May 15, 2016, the New York Times wrote, quote, President Obama, who ran as an anti-war candidate, has now been at war longer than any other American president, unquote. That was from the New York Times. And President Hillary Clinton is relying on fear of Trump to secure the nomination. Sanders and most liberals will argue that the Republicans are the key obstacle to progress. It is absolutely true that the Republican Party, since the 70s, has consistently championed police policies to undermine the public sector, make the rich even richer, and attack the gains of workers, black people, women, and LGBTQ people. However, what is left out of that narrative is that during the bulk of the past 40 years, there's been a division of power in Washington, D.C. between the Democrats and the Republicans. For most legislation to pass, it needed to be supported by sections of both parties. In other words, Democratic Party votes were needed to pass so-called Republican policies during the last four decades. Now, earlier in this show, I gave the example of EFCA, just recently in the show. Employee Free Choice Act, promised by the Democratic Party and Obama to gain labor support. And by the way, labor support is huge. It's like millions and hundreds of millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars. People like me, I've never done this for the Democrats, but I did this for Shama Sawan and other independent candidates, going door-to-door, canvassing in areas, you know, the Labor Party has provided a lot of on-the-ground troops, a lot of propaganda, and a lot of just money to the Democratic Party since the 30s, basically, unfortunately, with some exceptions here and there. In the 90s, there was an attempt by some unions to get a Labor Party going. That's a discussion for another time. We have talked about it in the previous shows. What I forgot to mention when I was mentioning EFCA is that I can see some people listening and saying, oh, you know, because I've gone through this drill on Facebook many times and at public meetings and so on that I've spoken at, where people have said, well, wait a minute, you know, Obama loves labor and EFCA, and he wanted EFCA, but it was the Republicans, they stopped it. They wouldn't let it go through, you know, and that's the general, like, refrain that you'll just hear over and over and over again from particularly lesser evilists, you know, that are going to be defending Hillary with one hand, and then every criticism you have of the Democratic Party, they'll come up with some lame, historically inaccurate, excuse for betrayal of the Democrats of their promises to cajole working people through left populism into believing the promises of the Democratic Party. So, EFCA, Employee Free Choice Act. Obama would have loved to get that in, except the darn Republicans got in his way. Oh, wait a minute, there's one little historical fact, lesser evilist, that you haven't thought about. Liberal. Listen, Liberal. Have you heard of that book? There's Listen, Liberal, a new book. I'm starting to read it by Thomas Frank. Frank is himself a liberal. He should listen to himself, maybe, I guess. But, you know, he wants to, I think, ultimately reform the Democratic Party. I have to be sure. I'm not sure of that. Don't quote me on that. I have to finish the book. But I think that's where it's leading. Listen, Liberal. Listen, lesser evilist. First 2 years of the Obama administration, the Democratic Party had the whole enchilada. They had the presidency. They had control of the House. They had control of the Senate. Okay? Same thing with Clinton. First 2 years of the Clinton administration, they had the presidency. They had control of the House. They had control of the Senate. They could have got anything passed. Anything. Anything, anything, anything. They didn't even try. They didn't even try to get EFCA passed. They didn't even try to get EFCA. And I could give you a whole laundry list of things they promised during elections they never tried to get passed. I just had a whole thing with an SEIU organizer on May Day, May 1st, in Worcester. I was in Worcester for International Workers' Day celebration, believe it or not, and the right in front of City Hall, a bunch of unions out there, a bunch of radical groups, left groups, Socialist Alternative was there. And I end up getting into it with a, very polite and all, but still, with an SEIU organizer. And he's this guy's like in his 30s, and he's giving me back stuff like lines like, well, let's not let 15 an hour be the enemy of 12 an hour, because 12 an hour would really help a lot of people, And I'm like, well, let's not let 12 be the enemy of 15. We already have 15 in a bunch of cities. Why do we have to go with Hillary's $12 minimum wage demand when 15 is becoming more and more standard in a lot of areas and more accepted in terms of in polling data and so on? And this guy's now hanging on to 12, And, and I come up with all these examples like the EFCA one and so on. And, he's just, this would be, I can't verbatim come back with his counter arguments because I just thought they were nonsense. And a lot of them just hung around sort of a general idea of what would be possible, and that promises are kept by corporate politicians in the Democratic or Republican parties. Now, that last thing, come on, man, you've been on the earth 30 years or something, 30 more years, and you're peddling that, really? And you have some influence over union workers? I mean, come on. And then on top of that, his other arguments were more along the lines of just, well, I just think it's just more possible that Clinton would get elected. I can't remember if he invoked Trump or not. The whole thing that Clinton is saying about Hillary, saying about she'll be the most effective against Trump. Interesting polling data showing Sanders actually be more effective against Trump. But again, the whole paradigm is foolish. The whole paradigm is getting one corporate politician or another one. One's not as evil as the other one. And Trump is like carries his evil on his sleeve, and he's proud of being an idiot, a bigot, Clinton, on the other hand, and Clinton is funny because Clinton's like, would you like Donald Trump in there ready to, with his hand on the nuclear trigger, Well, the answer is no, of course not. There shouldn't even be a nuclear trigger. So let's get into that, right? But leaving that aside for a moment, what's the thing? I'm not afraid of you, Hillary, having your finger on the nuclear trigger. You've been quite the zealot for war, Hillary Clinton. You have the corporate media basically agreeing that Libya was your war, and you went in there and you got Gaddafi tortured and killed, and that's just wonderful. How wonderful. Now there's a country split up, dirt poor, split up among competing warlords. And by the way, I'm not saying I had anything for Gaddafi or cared about Gaddafi. It's just that, if you really like your lesser evilist arguments, let's look at that. I don't buy into that, but let's look into that with Gaddafi and all that. Who is the lesser evil there, ISIS or Gaddafi? Because that's what you got now in Libya. You have a playground for ISIS and other warlords, and you've got the U.S. still doing proxy war there, and it's a complete mess, of course, and adding to the instability throughout the Middle East. And by instability, I don't mean instability for imperialism. I mean, I don't care about that. I like instability for imperialism. I mean, there's instability throughout the Middle East for the people. The people, the refugee crisis from Syria, the people in Libya that have been killed, innocent people bombed, killed. I mean, it's criminal. It's absolutely criminal. So, yeah, who do I want on the nuclear trigger? No one. Why does there have to be someone that doesn't, but I certainly don't trust Clinton's itchy trigger finger. Any more than Trump, hey, what's that button for? Boom, So anyway, getting back to this, can the Democratic Party be reformed? For a few more minutes before we start to wind up, and by the way, you are listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, and you're listening to Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio, and we're a little slice of that community base, and we have about 15 more minutes in the show. We're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., with talk and music from a working-class democratic socialist perspective. And let us read a public service announcement, because that's what we do. And I'm old school here. I'm going to go right for this, notebook and go for, these really tired old PSA. I'm sorry, no, these really important. They are important, I think. I love this one. I love this one, right? Okay, hold on. Stop the texts. Stop the wrecks. Public service announcement. Text messaging. A few facts about texting and driving. Fact number one, a texting driver is 23 times more likely to get into a crash than a non-texting driver. Fact number two, using a cell phone while driving, whether it's handheld or hands-free, Listen to that, my people. Hands-free. Delays a driver's reactions as much as having a blood alcohol concentration of the legal limit of 0.08%. Fact 3, distracted driving is now the number one killer of American teens. Fact number 4, this has been a public message, public safety message from StopTechStopRex.org and WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. And, you know, that's true. All that stuff's true. I believe in all that. I don't text and drive and so on. But I do talk on my phone sometimes, and that is distraction, I guess. And I'll have to deal with that. I'll have to pull over more is what I'll have to do. But you know how it is. Sometimes you can't. Numbers to think about, public service announcement. Some numbers to think about. The United States has less than 5% of the planet's population, but incarcerates, that means put in prison, 24% of its prisoners, and accounts for 43% of the world's total military spending. A public service message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. And by the way, that last factoid accounts for 43% of the world's total military spending. That is a mind-blowing statistic when broken down. It's sort of like you can add up, last time I ran into this, it was like an enormous amount of countries, their aggregate military spending. These are industrialized developed countries. The top seven or more than that combined, their aggregate military spending is still less than the military spending of just the United States. So what's going on? I mean, is that I just think about that. I mean, I don't even want to editorialize about that. What the heck would we have need that much military for? You know, and it's funny because even the really pro-imperialist capitalist rulers, they can't even use that much firepower. They know they don't want to start ground wars in certain places. They don't want to do this or that and piss off people they want to make money off of, you know? So it's like, even by their standards, it's an incredible waste. But of course, they're making money off it too. Anyway, back to this theme of, I guess it's become the theme of today's show, that and the Verizon strike, but can the Democratic Party be reformed? How progressive was Roosevelt? Quoting again from an article here dated, let's see, sorry for the paper shuffling, but that's the way we roll here. May 26th, 2016, by Tony Wilson and Tom Crean, Socialist Alternative, issue number 24, June issue of Socialist Alternative newspaper. How progressive was Roosevelt? Getting deeper into this article a little bit. Is a widespread view on the liberal left that what is needed to get the Democratic Party, quote, back to its roots, and we're talking here like Thomas Frank, that guy I mentioned earlier, Listen Liberal, I think that's where he's going with his book, new book. Get the Democratic Party back to its roots as an allegedly progressive party. Now, does that mean go back to the slave roots or go back to the, you know, genocide of Native Americans or the racism against Chinese work, you know, exploiting Chinese workers, you know, all the things that Democrats have done. It's just, anyway, there's a huge list. Now, central to this general narrative, though, of the mythical progressive roots of the Democratic Party are the Roosevelt administrations in the 30s and 40s and the Kennedy-Johnson administration in the 60s. The liberal view of Roosevelt rests on a whole series of reforms called the New Deal, which were enacted during his first administration. These included unemployment benefits, a sizable jobs program, Social Security, 40-week legislation, 40-hour-a-week legislation, and some controls on financial capital, including the Glass-Steagall Act, subsequently repealed by another Democratic president, Bill Clinton. However, what is missing from this narrative is why these policies were enacted. Roosevelt was elected in November 1932, 4 years into the Great Depression, which was caused by the collapse of financial speculation of the 20s. And Roosevelt was elected initially as a fiscal conservative. A lot of people don't know that, not directly quoting here, but he, you know, the thing from the 20s where labor had been severely repressed in this country, where Jim Crow racism was virulent, in the South, apartheid, lynching, you name it. The 20s were a very violent, violent decade. It wasn't the flapper era for a lot of workers. It was, you try to organize a union, you get killed. You try to fight for your rights as a black person, you get lynched. You try to be a socialist, you get deported if you're an immigrant, or you get thrown in prison. In the early 20s, 1917 into the early 20s and so on. You try to oppose World War I. This gets back into the teens more than the 20s, but just on the cusp of the 1920s. And you get viciously attacked Eugene Debs, for example, the leader of the Socialist Party, was thrown in prison for just speaking out in a roundabout way against going to war in World War One. And I don't know if you ever, you know, a lot of people know of F. Scott Fitzgerald based on The Great Gatsby. He had a really good story. He was a really good writer, obviously. Well, not obviously, but he was a really good writer. And he has a short story about, which no one knows about, of course. I had to find out about it when in France, actually. It's kind of a long story. But anyway, about after World War One, mobs of right-wingers going around looking for left-wing, like Socialist Party or IWW or whatever offices to loot, people to beat up, and so on. I think the story was called May 4th, and then I forget the date that he put in there. So anyway, getting back to this with a direct quote here. The liberal view of Roosevelt... Okay, right here, sorry. Roosevelt... Okay, unrest was growing across the country and when Roosevelt got elected, as tens of millions of unemployed and impoverished workers were close to starvation. Again, I'm going to stop the direct quotes for a minute and just say what was happening in the early 30s. Historically, you would say not much, and in some ways that was true. The official labor movement was you didn't have the CIO yet. You had the business unionist mentality from the 20s, where the radicals weren't shot or chased away. That left a core of an idiotocracy of labor leaders who believed in capitalism, contrary to what everyone was experiencing. And they didn't do anything from 29 to 34, and many of them didn't do anything at all after that, but there was another union federation that came out, the CIO, that did a lot. But the Communist Party was growing, and the Communist, the success of the Russian Revolution, at least initially, before the Stalinists took over and so on, led to a great wave of radicalization around the world, including the United States. The Communist Party was leading mass demonstrations in the United States in the from that slow period, so to speak, of 29 to 34, for relief, meaning unemployment, welfare payments. They called it relief back then, just for people could survive. They were leading huge protests against evictions and for housing rights. And all before they were really on the radar in that early period, they were leading sharecropper struggles in the South, integrated, by the way. Amazing work, despite internationally, the Stalinists had basically taken over, or were starting to take over, or were completing their takeover. So anyway, the strikes started to happen, demonstrations. I'm going to have to paraphrase here because of time. And it was all that pressure, the radicalizing labor movement, the growing influence of communists and socialists, a potential threat to the capitalist system, that forced Roosevelt. He didn't want to. It forced him to abandon fiscal conservatism. And this is the only way to have capitalism survive, basically. And he did a sort of Keynesian approach economically that was labeled socialism by his right-wing critics, but it was not. And while the New Deal policies did manage to give a temporary boost to the U.S. economy and gave hopes to tens of millions, he was not a friend of working people. In fact, he used to say to his right-wing critics, "Why are you after me? I'm saving capitalism for your butts," you know? As soon as the economy began to show signs of limited recovery, Roosevelt began dismantling the jobs programs, triggering a new slump. A lot of people aren't aware the recession wasn't one huge downward drop, like a bottomless drop. It had its moments where it started to recover or not, depending on what was going on. And one recovery was ruined by all of a sudden a dismantling of the jobs programs and other stimulus and brought back a depression. Under Roosevelt, the National Guard was used more times against the labor movement than any other president. The first engagement of U.S. troops in the 40s was against Union members in California, not against Japanese or German troops. Meanwhile, Japanese Americans were rounded up and put into detention camps by Roosevelt. Roosevelt suppressed strike action by workers throughout World War II, and before his death, he attempted to repress a wave of successful, powerful strikes in 1945 to 1946. Roosevelt's successor, Harry Truman, signed the Anti-Labor Taft-Hartley Act. Now, he did oppose it originally, but then he went along with it because there was a majority support of the Democratic Party in Congress for Taft-Hartley, which was infamous at the time and still should be. It made many of the most successful picketing tactics by labor illegal and further tied labor's hands with legal restrictions of all sorts. The leadership of the unions accepted the situation based on other concessions made in the post-war period, including the GI Bill, but also because they were promised, quote, a seat at the table, unquote, with big business. The latter, however, was also conditional on the labor movement not forming its own party. and remaining in the orbit of the Democratic Party, a fatal mistake. And also, I'll add to that, part of the deal back then, this dirty deal of the late 1940s, which is a crucial time people need to know more about, was, hey, we'll let you get closer to power with the government if you give up organizing the South. Come to the Democratic Party, have a seat at the table. There's all these other little concessions we'll do, GI Bill or whatever. GI Bill was huge, not a little thing, but still. But that's so you don't organize the South. You don't do a mass, and they agreed to it. The labor leaders agreed to it. You don't do a mass organizing drive in the South in the late 1940s into the 50s. If that had happened, if they had stayed clear of the Democratic Party, done a mass organizing drive in the South, we'd be living in a much different country at this point in time. So we're going to have to continue that, the Kennedy Johnson era and so on, next time, because the lesser evilist thing isn't going to go away, and we're going to have to deal with that, and we're going to deal with it head on. And, you know, we're sympathetic. Trump is evil, but so is Clinton, and so is the system. So you've been listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class Democratic Socialist perspective. And we want to thank you for listening. Thank our regular listeners from around the globe, actually, due to the wonders of the internets. And go to Facebook, Socialist Alternative Radio, and check us out there. We're always putting stuff on the page. It's pretty darn entertaining and informative. And also check back 2 weeks from now here at 91.5 FM, Tufts Free Form, commercial-free, community-based radio. We're going to go out with kind of one of our theme songs here, and we hope you enjoy it.
Sky.